My beloved grandma died a few years ago, not long actually after John and I got married. And when that happened, my family and I did all the right stuff that you're supposed to do. My sister and I packed up and we headed home to be with the people we love. We made the calls and we spoke our deepest prayers. And we shook the hands of all of our fellow mourners in that seemingly endless stream of good wishes and heartfelt condolences that come at such times. At the viewing, we stood by the casket and we nodded and we accepted the care that was so graciously offered to us. And I found myself, for some reason, feeling compelled to tell all these near strangers whom I had not seen since John and I got married, not only how gracious it was that they were there to mourn my grandmother, but how nice it was for them to have gotten us wedding presents. I found myself saying things like, "Thank you for being here for Grandma. I know she would appreciate your presence, and I do enjoy that salad spinner." Truth be told, the whole practice of public mourning was getting more than a little laborious. Every time someone came through the line, there was another story, another memory, another aspect of this beloved woman to grieve the loss of. And through it all, I did what I do, which is be competent. I did what was asked of me, and through it all, I did not cry. I did not cry when I got the call to come home and come home fast. I did not cry at her bedside when she actually died. I did not cry when my big sister melted into a puddle and my dad said his silent goodbyes. I did not cry as I shook the seemingly endless stream of hands, at least not for a really long time. Until finally, when the viewing was almost at an end, a very religiously conservative, kind, and deeply concerned family friend came through the line. I looked at her and apparently, through with propriety, proceeded to excitedly pump her fist while loudly exclaiming, "Dude, somebody must have sold their soul to the devil to design that ice cream scoop you gave me." Every gaze in that room turned to look at me, and this poor woman, who after all actually believes people can sell their souls to the devil, looked at me in wide-eyed terror, as if I had just confirmed all her long-held suspicions of me. Gathering herself, she graciously said, "I'm sorry for your loss," and walked on. And right then, after days of propriety and strength and being there for everyone who needed me, I lost it and laughed so hard I thought I might soil my pants. I had to leave the room. And not long after that, broken open with laughter, I found myself sitting in the dumpy little funeral home kitchen, surrounded by cold cut trays and jello molds and a sheet cake that inexplicably had a picture of my grandma's face airbrushed upon it. And I found myself finally crying when I could not do it before. Friedrich Nietzsche, I know it's a sermon about humor and I'm quoting Nietzsche, you know. Friedrich Nietzsche once defined the sacred as that which you cannot laugh at. Whatever is most holy, most elementally important, that is the thing that it's best not to make fun of. And he's on to something with that. Some things deserve reverence, and reverence has with it a certain gravitas, a series of intent that doesn't go hand in hand with general knee-slapping goofiness. There must be room in our lives for reverence, room in our sanctuary for reverence, reverence even for something as holy as death itself. Some may argue that the entire point of a sanctuary like this one is reverence, that the entire reason religion exists as an institution is to take upon itself the responsibility of being a place for reverence, and this, I think, is usually an admirable goal. Our sanctuary ought to be safe for those moments when we need not fun times, but a safe harbor from the buffeting storm. Being a place of reverence is a virtue, but every virtue has its shadow side. And reverence, when allowed to harden into propriety and the lesser forms of kneeling piety, reverence has a way of taking a living thing like faith and turning it into a stony, cold statue of itself that no longer pulses with the life of the Spirit. The shadow side of reverence has long been guilty of robbing religion of greater truths that can only be found when we let go of all of our control and all of our propriety and most of our piety. I went to seminary near the campus of the University of Chicago, and students there used to wear t-shirts that said, "The University of Chicago, where fun goes to die." And it's not much of a stretch to say that's pretty much what many people think of religion. Church, where fun goes to die. In an attempt to be reverent in the face of the sacred, too often the faithful of the world swing so far that the whole business of congregational living and worship starts to feel empty, and it loses its ability to represent the whole span of the human experience from belly laughs to great big sobs. In an attempt to be appropriate to the gravity of the world's great questions, faith too often loses touch with the honest silliness of the human condition. The resulting coldness of heart and hardness of edges is what a living faith has got to fend off if it's going to be relevant in the real world. And one of the greatest tools we have for fending off our coldness and our hardness of heart is the gift of laughter that we can't fend off even if we wanted to. It was also Nietzsche who argued that Christian religion as an institution had built itself largely around an ascetic, self-denying principle of the priesthood, things like poverty, chastity, and obedience, and that in doing so it created a worldview where suffering was necessary for eventual blessing, and a repudiation of this natural world we are surrounded by made way for the other world to come. In other words, Nietzsche thought that the institution of Christian religion was a big fat bummer. The church, he thought, was no fun at all. And moreover, it did all of its work within a philosophical framework that said fun was dubious at best and downright sinful at worst. This was the idea of a priestly church founded on deprivation and condemnation, and it was, he said, quite different from the teachings of Jesus. You see, this man who said God is dead actually believed that Jesus taught good news. He believed that Jesus taught that the task of the soul yearning was not to feel guilt, but to feel gratitude for a life that we could all live well if we try hard enough. Jesus, Nietzsche said, was a bearer of glad tidings. He came to show people how to live. He said it was not a religion, but a way of life that Jesus bequeathed to humankind. Now, I personally have always thought Jesus was a kind of funny guy. Just think of a camel trying to pass through the eye of a needle, and you at least get a sense that he was a little wacky in there somewhere. Maybe it's true that we cannot laugh at some things that are truly sacred, but it's also true that laughter is often the close companion of the sacred. It stands in the presence of all that's most holy. We don't laugh at sacred things, but we darn well do laugh in the vicinity of sacred things. If only because our very attempts to understand and uphold the sacred inevitably come up against our human foibles and failures, and the only honest thing to do when we're bumbling around so thoroughly is to laugh. I imagine the great sages, the wisest among us, spending 9 days out of 10 deeply in prayer, trying to comprehend and uphold that which is sacred, and the 10th day belly laughing at how much they've mucked it up and how goofy we all look when we're trying to keep a straight face. There are great teachers of all traditions who understand this truth. There are silly sages throughout the annals of religious history, and most people who meet the Dalai Lama freely report that he's a pretty funny guy. Even the ancient medieval Christian church understood the inherent silliness of the religious enterprise, understood that everything we do to understand God is just a goofy child's game in the face of a mystery. And once a year, the medieval Christian church explicitly acknowledged that silliness in, and I am not making this up, the Ass Mass. True story. The Ass Mass, the Feast of the Ass, which took place on January 14th every year, a date which also happens to coincide with the Catholic feast day of one Saint Hilarius. And I'm not making that up either. Seriously, look it up, Saint Hilarius. Saint Hilarius, by the way, was also known as the Hammer of the Arians. And since the Arians in the early church were a sort of proto-Unitarian set of heretics, I don't think that if Hilarius made an appearance here, we'd find it funny at all. But I digress. The Ass Mass, or the Festum Asinorum, originally celebrated the Holy Family's flight into Egypt, but at some point it became conflated with the more secular Feast of Fools, which also took place in that in-between space from Christmas to Lent. In the same general category, see also Mardi Gras. Anyway, there's no one way to celebrate an Ass Mass, and it has many different manifestations, but the elements that were fairly uniform over the years included a beautiful maiden riding into the sanctuary upon an ass, who took his honored place to the right of the altar for the remainder of the Mass. After that, the most inferior and poorly educated clergy person present was elected the head priest, or pope of the Mass, given a fancy hat to wear, and established as the lord of the feast. This is an honor that, as perhaps the only clergy person here present this morning, and thus by default the least educated and most inferior minister at these proceedings, I shall have to take upon myself. The lord of the feast thusly in place. The priest began the day's prayers, and in place of the usual responses, the people responded not with amen, but with loud choruses of hee-haw! And at the conclusion of the service, the priest, instead of offering the benediction, hee-hawed loudly three times and was answered by a general cacophony of braying, whereupon everyone went and had a party. Again, I'm not making this up. Apparently in 1431 and 1444, some big buzzkill tried to ban the Ass Mass in France, but some version of it carried on and is still practiced in some parts of Europe even today. Good time. In church and in religious life, upon the twisting paths of our spiritual journeys, we can try all we want to be proper. We can try to do the right things at the right times, but every once in a while, or perhaps quite often, we have to admit that the whole mess is a little bit goofy and stop pretending we've got it all figured out. On this count, I think we Unitarian Universalists might be well ahead of the game. As I sometimes tell folks far and wide, in our faith tradition, we do not suffer under the delusion that we are the smartest or the best people in the whole world. Indeed, we do not even suffer under the delusion that we've got the answers and everybody ought to be just like us. Rather, we try to allow room for the full range of the human experience in this place, from our great certainties to our glaring foolishness, from our reverence to our belly laughs and back again, sometimes so fast it's hard to keep up. The point of church may well be to revere what is sacred and to lift it up before our eyes. This thing we're doing here is serious stuff. But we, and those people of faith who join us in welcoming the whole person into our sanctuary, strive for a kind of reverence that avoids the pitfalls of self-seriousness and sanctimony. A kind of reverence that knows its own limits, and a kind of faith that's humble enough to laugh at our own flawed efforts to pin down the mystery, let alone give it a name like God. Reverence is important in the face of the great questions and the deep truths, And that reverence should always, always leave the door open to the uncontrollable and unbidden gift of laughter. I tried so hard to be appropriate in that handshake line after my grandmother died. I tried so hard to evince the proper gravitas for the sacred and serious situation in which I found myself. I nodded at all the right times, and I filled my allotted role, and nothing could successfully crack me open to the whole painful and marvelous depth of the situation until a force beyond my control took over and left me worried that if I didn't settle down, we were going to have a problem. And then I cried. I cried only after the laughter forced me to stop being appropriate. I cried and I could let go and feel what I was feeling. And I challenge anyone, absolutely anyone, to sit next to a sheet cake with the face of a newly deceased elderly woman on it and not both laugh and cry at the same time. Because it's silly, these things we do, trying to be appropriate. It's always silly and a little futile. And there's no sense denying it, because if we do, we're faking it anyway. Even our efforts at being serious are profoundly silly. And admitting the truth of that silliness sometimes opens the door for deeper, more necessary emotions like grief, like gratitude, like joy. For me, when I needed it most, laughter was a gateway to tears. It was a release of energy that softened my heart and that took over control, if only for a short while. Our reading today from Madeline Lingle reminded us that we are called to take ourselves seriously enough to take ourselves lightly. May we, from time to time, be overcome by the goofiness of this sacred endeavor. And may we laugh right to and through our tears, always proud to be the bumbling, silly, ever on the verge of a pratfall people we have always been. May it be so, and amen.